Psalm 2, starting verse 1. Why do the nations rage and the peoples plot in vain? The kings of the earth set themselves and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, let us burst their bonds apart and cast away their cords from us. Broken also into four sections. I didn't mention that too, just which most Bibles break these into four, three verse sections too. So the first one is the nation's opposition to God is just what I've called it. Second set of three verses, starting verse 4, he who sits in the heavens laughs. Lord holds them in derision. Then he will speak to them in his wrath and terrify them in his fury, saying, as for me, I have set my king on Zion, my holy hill. So that's God's reaction and God's response to these earthly, corrupt earthly leaders and rulers and peoples. Jesus then also has his own telling of this as well, verse 7 through 9. I will tell of the decree. The Lord said to me, you are my son. Today I have begotten you. Ask of me, and I will make the nations your heritage and the ends of the earth your possession. You shall break them with a rod of iron and dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel. And then the fourth section, which is a warning to the nations, those rulers of the first three verses. Now, therefore, O kings, be wise, be warned, O rulers of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear and rejoice with trembling. Kiss the Son, lest he be angry and you perish in the way, for his wrath is quickly kindled. Blessed are all who take refuge in him. So if you remember, just as a way of recap, two times ago when I did devotion, we were here, and I kind of went through some tools that you can use in, or that I've used in study that just kind of aid in that. We kind of looked at Bible Hub, which has some different translation tools, Strong's Concordance, which will translate Hebrew to English, the morphology of Hebrew as it relates to itself as other parts of Hebrew. We also saw that there are a few, how to use Bible Hub to understand words in their original context. And we came up ultimately with our own kind of translation or paraphrase just from our own study, not to discount anything as it's translated, you know, in our Bibles, of course, but just a translation of our own to kind of own it for ourselves, which was why were, why are, and why will the nations be in constant commotion and restlessness? Why are various nations of people conspiring and scheming and plotting in vain? Worthless emptiness. The kings of the earth take their stand and set themselves against God, and the rulers fix themselves upon conspiring together against, over, upon, and above God and his anointed son. It's a lot of extra language that gets added in there, but as you do a translation, you see that these are a lot of the context, kind of amplifies, I guess you could say, even some of what's there. Or as 2 Timothy calls us to do, to study to show ourselves approved. The last time we looked, we were not here. We looked at verses 3 and 4 and we were out at Campus Struma. So I got to shout loud and proud at that one. So and Mr. Todd gave me a nice pep talk beforehand. He said, hey man, no pressure, no pressure. So, but anyway, if verse 1 was starts with a question, why all this restlessness, this raging and this plotting in vain, verse 3 was the answer, because they want to burst the bonds, their bonds apart, being God and Jesus's, and when cast away their cords. Saw that this is actually that they're not only seeking to just undermine God's authority over them, but they're actually seeking to come between God and his son. I guess one correlation or one, you know, kind of analogy you could have is if you have a very, very obstinate child who not only wants to break out from under your rule, but also wants to drive a wedge between you and your spouse. I mean, that's a very earthly, very limited analogy to say what these rulers are seeking to do. They're not just saying, leave us alone. They're saying, we're so opposed to you. We're opposed to your union. We're opposed to the connection between Father, Son, and Spirit. We also see this throughout Jesus's ministry too. He gets challenged by things where his divinity is called into question. The Jews answered him, are we not right in saying that you are a Samaritan and have a demon? Well, if he has a demon, he's the opposite of God. He's, you know, on the complete other side of the spectrum. We're not stoning you for your good work, they reply, but for blasphemy, because you, a mere man, claim to be God. So again, they're challenging his claim to be God. if you are the Son of God, tell these stones to become bread. That's Satan's challenge to him, saying, hey, if you're going to be God, well, then prove it. Show me how you're God. So they hate God's connection to his Son, and they seek to destroy it. And we get the same from lost sinners. I'm presenting you with facts. You're just quoting a book. Things like that that you hear people say. Can't you just leave me alone to live my life? I'm not hurting anyone doing what I'm doing. It's like, yeah, but you telling me to do that is telling me not to do something that my God told me to do, which is to tell you about him. You say that's the truth, but that's just your truth. So it's undermining God's de facto fact, truth, reality, trying to understand it in light of some sort of relativism. We also saw that they want to cast away their cords from us. That's in verses 3 and 4. This was like God tells Israel when they leave Egypt, each of you get rid of your vile images that they had from the time that they were in Egypt. It's very accusatorial. They're basically saying, God, we're not only saying we don't want your cords on us and attached to us. They're saying they're disgusting. That we have no palate for them. We don't want them. The whole cord itself is to be detested. We want to throw that off. Let us cast away their cords. I don't want to live by their standards. That's what they're saying to God. Isaiah 53:6 says the same as well. All like sheep have gone astray. We have turned everyone to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. So this is something that all of us can relate to, hopefully, in our past. Verse 3, we also said, just kind of our own summary from the study a few weeks ago, was let us undermine and destroy God's connection to Christ, and let us cast aside and throw off God's connection to us and his direction of us. So that kind of reveals a lot more clearly, at least, you know, to me, because I studied it and owned it. That reveals to me a little bit more clearly, you know, what's really going on. How is this opposition happening? It's not just a bunch of people that are like, we don't really like God. No, it's like they're actively seeking to destroy his connection with his Son, and they're seeking to destroy his lordship over them, or claim of lordship. We also then looked at what is God's reaction to all the scheming and plotting of his anointed. And, you know, I found it a bit surprising, honestly. He sits in the heavens and laughs, and he holds them in derision. But I guess it totally makes sense as well. I mean, God is not sitting up in the heavens going, oh, my goodness, how do I combat this enemy? You know, he's not fretting. He's not fearing. He's not concerned. He knows intimately. He knows it far more intimately than they even know of their own planet plotting. He knows the condition of their heart far more than they do. God holds them in derision, which is contempt, contemptuous ridicule or mockery. So God ridicules and mocks the fools in their foolishness. And Ephesians 2 tells us that we were all once there. We were laughed at and derided by God following the world, the schemes of the devil, and the passions of the flesh. But thankfully, that is not a child of God's relationship with God any longer. Today, we're moving on to verses 5 and 6. I don't have a lot of slides today, so yeah, that's just six. Okay. So verses 5 and 6, the first paragraph there. Then he will speak to them in his wrath and terrify them in his fury. The first word of verse 5, then, of course, is talking, putting things on a timeline, saying then, if something precedes then, well, what preceded it? Of course, God and he's laughing and mocking them. But then God has a much more clear response to them. It says, then he will speak to them in his wrath. The Hebrew word there for wrath is af. His definition is nostril, nose, face, or oddly enough, anger. You're kind of like, how do all of those go together? Well, af is used in Exodus 32. And I think this passage really gives much more clarity around what is meant by wrath, or to what extent is this wrath. So imagine God's, or understand God's reaction in light of Exodus 32. starting verse 9. And the Lord said to Moses, I have seen this people, and behold, it is a stiff-necked people. Now therefore, let me alone, that my wrath may burn hot against them, and I may consume them, in order that I may make a great nation of you. This is when Moses is up on the mountain talking to God, getting the Ten Commandments. Meanwhile, the people are down, you know, at the base of the hill, and they're like, I don't know where Moses went. This guy, he led us out of Egypt. We just saw a sea part in front of us to get us away, then flood and destroy all of our enemies. Why don't we go ahead and make a golden calf? I mean, you know, I think nowadays that sounds like the most bonkers, crazy reaction to, like, what? You just went through all of this stuff, and yet I know in my own life, and probably much less, I guess, profoundly memorable ways of seeing a sea part and seeing my enemies drown, there have been many times when I've been like, just 3 days ago, I saw the Lord answer, you know, can't remember what the particular thing, I was trying to remember this, but there were so many things when I was living in North Carolina, I started dating Lauren, I ended up moving down here, and the Lord just orchestrated so many things I never could have planned. I mean, like, down to the timing of things, the way I quit my job and how that all worked out. I was able to get rid of most of my stuff really fast. Chapel Hill is a town that if you live in a fairly low-priced house, the odds of you selling your house outside of the summer are almost impossible because everybody comes into school to go to the university. If they're in the, like, low-budget housing market, they're only buying houses in this little narrow window, and that's when they know they got into school. They're not going to buy a house in February because they don't know if they're going to school there. They'll wait till May or June or July. Sure enough, I remember a conversation I had with a guy 4 months before. He was looking to move to Chapel Hill from the far side of Raleigh, driving an hour to work every day. And he was in my group, but I hardly ever saw him. So anyway, I talked to him, and I was just like, hey, are you still looking for a house? He was like, yeah, can I come over and look, you know, at your house tomorrow? I was like, yeah, sure. Never talked to a realtor, had one conversation that literally lasted 2 minutes. And the guy showed up with his parents, who were Christians, who had previously bought and sold houses, had filled out all the paperwork and never gone through a realtor. So they were like, oh, no, we do this all the time. We'll fill out all the paperwork. If you want to go talk to a lawyer or whatever, just make sure it's all in the up and up. That's cool. But we do it all the time. We'll take care of it. So they were like, sign here, 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 and here. I sold a house on literally 1 2-minute conversation. I didn't orchestrate a single thing. I could never have done that, even if I tried to, and spent hours doing it. You know, there was just a series of things like that. And it was just, it was not long afterwards. You know, I don't remember what my failing was, but I do remember I got here. I had been here for a week. I had seen this series of things happen over a course of like 3 months. That was just, I don't know, just like one of those mountaintop experiences. It was like, wow. And then I'm just totally like, how have I so quickly forgotten the Lord's faithfulness over the last few weeks? And now here I am, just a short time later, falling on my face over and over again in the same stupid sin, you know? You know, in a similar way, I can relate to, you know, the Israelites in this, making my own golden calf, I guess you could say. Continuing, though, in Exodus 32 says, verse 11, but Moses implored the Lord his God and said, O Lord, why does your wrath, your ass, burn hot against your people, whom you have brought out of the land of Egypt with great power and mighty hands? Why should the Egyptians say, with evil intent did he bring them out, to kill them in the mountains and to consume them from the face of the earth? Turn from your burning anger or your wrath, and relent from this disaster against your people. In verses 10 and 11, Af is used as wrath, God's wrath against his people for this disgusting sin that they're even committing as Moses and God are having this conversation. It's happening simultaneously. It isn't something that Moses discovered and happened before. It's going on in real time at that moment. But then you get to verse 12 and it turns to burning anger. This is actually, there's a change here a little bit in the Hebrew in the way that the words are pieced together. It's wrath that leads to action. There's something that follows it. It isn't just anger burning within. It's anger that actually then manifests itself into some sort of action. It's similar to later in that same passage in Exodus, verses 19 and 20. And as soon as he came near the camp and saw the calf and the dancing, he being Moses, Moses' anger or his wrath burned hot. So what does he do? Throws down the tablets out of his hands and broke them at the foot of the mountain. And he took the calf that they had made, he burned it in the fire, and he ground it to powder and scattered it in the water and made the people of Israel drink it. So he's so infuriated and so angry that his anger ends up manifesting into action. It's the same here in Psalm 2:5, where God's wrath causes him to take action. And what is that action? It says he speaks. One more note on app that I also found not long after that same, it's kind of the conclusion of this whole passage in Exodus 32. It actually takes place in Exodus 34. And it appears again. So Moses cut two tablets of stone like the first, and he rose early in the morning and went up on Mount Sinai as the Lord had commanded him. He took in his hand two tablets of stone. The Lord descended in the cloud and stood with him there and proclaimed the name of the Lord. The Lord passed before him and proclaimed, the Lord, a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger, or af, bound and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness, keeping steadfast love for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin, but who will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on their children and the children's children to the third and fourth generation. So we see the other extreme of this, still anger, still righteous, still holy, but instead of being moved to action, to God wants to destroy the people, and he's talking to Moses about it, who talks him out of it. Moses' righteous anger, and that he goes down and deals with the people. We see that God is slow to anger. That's something, obviously, as you know, his children, we benefit from. There's an incredible example, actually, that all of us who are believers can relate to. So in Romans 5, 8 through 10, it says, "But God shows his love for us in that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us, slow to anger, patient. Since therefore we have now been justified by his blood, how much more shall we be saved by him from the wrath of God?" But Christ intercedes to stop that wrath from taking, from manifesting into it being laid out on us, because it was already laid out on Christ. The next section of verse 5 is that he will terrify them. The Hebrew there is bahal. It means to disturb or terrify. So that's translated a lot like it appears, but it is the type of word it is the piel imperfect, which is just a Hebrew type of type of verb. It's an active verb that is extremely intense. And is often repeated, not in this passage, but in most passages in the Old Testament is repeated when it's used. Even the way I just worded that summary could be kind of a form of it. I said extremely intense. Well, intense by its own definition is extreme. It has intensity to it. So if you throw in extreme in the front, you've now just made a two-word kind of redundant phrase. But as we see often in Scripture, when we talk about often in Scripture, redundancy or repetition, not redundancy, but repetition actually underscores its severity. We see this also in Exodus 23 and 24. "My angel will go ahead of you and bring you into the land of the Amorites, Hittites, Perizzites, Canaanites, Hivites, and Jebusites, and I will wipe them out. Do not bow down before their gods or worship them or follow their practices. You must demolish them and break their sacred stones to pieces." So demolish kind of implies you're going to obliterate things into nothing or into like fine sand or fine pieces. But it also says, and break them to pieces. It's the same word that's used there. So these people back in Psalm 2, there's extreme and utter terror for the nations, the peoples, the kings, the rulers who oppose God when he speaks to them. This is similar to some New Testament concepts that we actually see. Peter, James, and John are up there, up on the mountain with Jesus at the Transfiguration. And it says, when the disciples heard this, going back to verse 5, he was still speaking when, behold, a bright cloud overshadowed them, and a voice from the cloud said, "This is my beloved Son, with whom I am well pleased. Listen to him." So God takes it. He speaks, which is what is said also here in Psalm 2. And what is the disciples' reaction? They don't go, "Ooh, that was kind of scary." It says, when the disciples heard this, they fell on their faces and were terrified. That's the voice of God being heard, being brought forth. We also see it when Saul encounters Jesus in Acts 9. It says, Saul's going on his way. He approached Damascus, and suddenly a light from heaven shone around him. And falling to the ground, he heard a voice say to him, "Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me?" Verse 6 says, "As for me, I have set my king on Zion, my holy hill." So God not only speaks, but God speaks of his actions. "As for me, I have set." Set is, it is nosach. It is a great example of sometimes where you can go, oh, maybe there's a little bit lacking in this translation in English. The definition actually does not mean to just set, as in to put something in place. It means to pour out. It's typically used of things like liquid metal, or like gold being poured out into a mold. It's also qual perfect singular, which basically is a Hebrew word form. It means a one-time completed act. It's not something ongoing. It's not something that has to be done in the future. It's not something that has to be repeatedly done. Something that happened one time, completed, and it's perfect. It's completed. Call perfect is amongst the strongest verb forms in Hebrew. It's not just to set or to put in place. In other words, this king's term has no expiration. He wasn't just put in place. He was poured out once and for all of eternity. So a translation could be, "As for me, I have poured out once and forever my king." That takes it to a whole different level than, oh, well, God set Joe Biden in office for 4 years. Well, no. God poured out his son for all of eternity. That's a drastic difference. It has no timeline. The next section, or next part of it, says, "My king." This is a combination of Hebrew words used here that used elsewhere refer to a king in the Davidic line under God's protection. It's also used in prophesying the Messiah. In Jeremiah 23, it says, "The days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will raise up for David a righteous branch, a king or a nasah, who will reign wisely and do what is just and right in the land." In Zechariah 9:9, it says, "Rejoice greatly, daughter Zion. Shout, daughter Jerusalem. See, your king, your nasach, comes to you righteous and victorious, lowly and riding on a donkey, on a colt, and a foal of a donkey." So at this point in the history of the psalm, God has set out and he has already set and poured out his eternal king. He's also a prophesying of his earthly arrival. We also see where he's putting him. He's putting him in Zion, which is a mountain in Jerusalem. It was captured by David, and it is sometimes translated in scripture, instead of as Zion, as sanctuary or holy place, or even as the nation Israel, God's chosen people. David made Zion his residence, so that makes it the seat of him as a king. In Psalm 2:6, Zion is called my holy hill. So it is where God has poured out his eternal king. So that not just makes it some seat of a king, the seat of David, but that actually makes it the seat of the eternal king, Jesus, the one that he poured out. Goes on to call it also holy, which that Hebrew word means apartness or sacredness. And it's used extensively in Exodus to describe God's holy presence. When Moses is standing talking to God, it says he's standing on holy ground, or Kodesh, which is the Hebrew word here. It's the sacred assembly of God's people in Exodus 12. It's God's holy Sabbath in Exodus 16. It's the Holy of Holies in Exodus 26. And that's like four examples of literally it's used about 70 times just in Exodus to talk about all the different ways in which God is holy, places that are holy, things used in his worship that are holy, priestly garments that are holy. So this sets this place far, far above, far separated in terms of being a kingly seat for an eternal king that was poured out. So in other words, just to kind of summarize what we had today, after laughing and mocking at the rulers who would seek to break God's bond with his son, God's direct answer to these fools is found in verse 6, which is pouring out his eternal king on his eternal seat, which is sacred and set apart, is above all others forever. And not only that, but these rulers also have a very specific reaction to that, and that is that they have utter and complete terror at the prospect of that. But thankfully, kind of like I think I ended two times ago, that is not our reaction as God's people. As God's people, we have the opportunity to approach him in confidence, in boldness, call to his spirit, to take our pleas and our prayers, and to present them to him in a voice that is too deep and too beyond any words that we could ever come up with. So powerful stuff from just even two verses from Psalm 2.